You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, cloudy, cold.
None of the above.
It was 100 degrees yesterday, and it's going to be 70 next week. What is going on?
We had big bunch of clouds pushing in at sunrise this morning. I got some great pictures of them because it was quite beautiful. We're on the leading edge of a storm, I guess you can call it. Yes, today's date, I'm reminded by a longtime listener that we need to say this. Today's date is September 24th for broadcast of the show, September 25th, 2025. Yesterday's temperature, the 23rd, was 99.2 degrees, according to the Simms Weather Station. We kept checking to see, did we get to 100 degrees? Well, not quite. I'm sure somewhere in the area, someone probably got to 100 degrees. We were at 99.2 degrees, and the day before was about 96, 97. Well, today is going to be 85. Thursday is going to be 86. Friday is going to be 93. Saturday, 84. And Sunday, 77. So 99.2 degrees to 77 degrees in 1 week. It must be fall. And yes, it officially is fall now. We've got increasing clouds today, a slight chance of thunderstorms, then mostly cloudy tonight with a low only 63. We've been several degrees above average at night. And in fact, last night was still and pretty muggy by our standards here in Northern California. We'll be back into the 50s on Thursday night, 57 degrees. Friday, 93, as noted. Friday night, 59. Saturday night, 57. And that's all clearing. And then Monday, chance of showers. Partly sunny with a high near 77. Monday night, chance of showers, mostly cloudy, 56. And Tuesday, a chance of showers, mostly sunny with a high near 76. So if you have vegetables on your summer vegetable plants, let's say tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, things like that, sometime in the next few days, you probably want to start picking some of those because we are going to be a lot cooler in the daytime. Not cold enough to really spoil things, but the moisture will stay on the fruit into the morning, and if bacterial spoilage begins, it'll move pretty quickly. Other than that, we've been having great fruit set weather, great ripening weather for a lot of the summer vegetables here in Northern California over the last week or so. And we should continue to harvest those right on through October, as long as we have the spells of dry, sunny, windy weather that we're accustomed to here. October is a pretty capricious month here in the Sacramento Valley. I have records of years where we had 3 or 4 major north wind events in October and early November, and then years where it's been very mild and rapidly progressed into fall and then seemingly winter-like conditions. When I mention those north wind events, they're very summer-like. They are dry, they're windy, of course, you know, we're talking 20, 30 mile an hour sustained winds and gusty winds higher than that, very low humidity, 5, 10, 15%, and they can go on for a couple of days. Those of you in Southern California, it's like the Santa Ana winds. In fact, it happens at the same time you tend to get those. They typically happen here in October and have been happening more and more in the last 10 to 20 years into November and even into December. There were no Santa Ana winds in December when I was a kid growing up in San Diego. They are happening now. So there's a little marker of climate change right there. For us, though, it looks like balmy, pleasant weather with the hottest day over the next several Friday at 93 degrees, sunny and clear with a storm coming in starting next week. Still plenty of time to plant vegetables, obviously. A lot of people coming in and talking about things like that. So we'll get into that, of course, as we always do. But we got a couple of our PSA-type announcements. Lois.
Okay, so we have talked on the show a lot about the Master Gardeners, and the Yolo County Master Gardeners have repeating events. We've mentioned it before. I'll do it again really quickly. Gardening for year-round meals. That's a hands-on class held at the Davis United Methodist Garden in the back called Grace Garden, and 1620 Anderson Road in Davis. And they are coming up October 11th, November 8th, December 13th. So once a month.
That's great.
And
That what is called gardening for year-round meals.
yeah,
My
and then
mother did
Easter.
that. She picked something from the garden. She was proud of this every day of the year and put things in the freezer. And I've had a couple customers over the years ask me, "Can I really grow all my own vegetables?" To which my answer is, "That depends on what vegetables you prefer to eat, but yes, you can." So head
And
over to
how
this event.
frequently you're willing to eat it.
Well, it's like, can you, if you have to have a salad with lettuce every day of the year, that's a challenge in the Sacramento Valley, but you can have a vegetable from your garden every day of the year, no problem.
So they also have the Master Gardener series at the Yolo County Library, and that is a Zoom discussion from 3 to 4 p.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of each month, that being October 9th and 23rd, November 13th and 27th, December 11th and 25th. And if I went too fast for you to write it all down, you do know that you can go and listen to our archives at kdrt.org, and all of our shows are archived there. So you can go and listen to it and pause it and listen to it and pause all that good stuff. Anyway, there's more. We'll do more next week.
Next
But Don,
week, it
isn't this a time when we're supposed to make money?
make money. Yes, our birthday. KDRT is having a birthday. 21 years of grassroots radio that would not be possible without the support of listeners like you. Next week is our big birthday celebration. We'll play birthday music to start the show. Maybe, who knows? There'll be a big birthday party down at the Sudwerk Dock. And we do, at that point, ask you for funds. And so we are going to start doing that. And I'll go ahead and just right now tell you that you can make a one-time gift now, or you can consider a monthly donation, which helps us plan throughout the year. In fact, we love those monthly donations, even in small amounts. Knowing they'll come in every month is very helpful for our budget. Gotta say something, folks. Nonprofits are having a really hard time right now. Okay, I'm involved in another one. We're all watching as the grant funds evaporate and the whole grant environment is changing. And so we really rely on those personal donations from listeners like you at this point. So regardless of the amount, whether you do a monthly donation, whether you do a one-time donation, just visit kdrt.org/donate. And we really appreciate all of your contributions.
Okay, Holly from Redlands. Now you remember Holly. She's written to us a few times lately. And she says, I wanted to thank you for your help with my tomato plants. I took your advice and looked up more information on tomato russet mites and inspected my plants more closely. I really think you may be onto something. My plants do appear to have the symptoms of a russet mite infestation, and all of them are putting out healthy new growth near the base, which, as you said, is inconsistent with verticillium wilt. So I will practice good sanitation and continue to monitor the situation.
Yeah, and this is a problem I encountered way back when, oh, in the 1980s, I was planting tomatoes and we went away on vacation. My sister took care of the watering and whatnot. And then we came back. We'd been gone for 8 or 10 days. And it was in late summer, and the plants looked like they were drying out from the bottom up. They were desiccating, but they were still growing, and they were, because she kept the water going, that was good news. And they were still flowering, they're still trying to fruit, but obviously everything was stunted because the older leaves were browning badly. It's hard to spot tomato russet mite. This isn't like spider mites on your house plant where you can see them with your naked eye if you're younger than 50, and you can see them with just a 10 power hand lens without much difficulty. Spider mites on house plants and outdoors, the two spot mite or the red spider mite, are visible. It would take a 40 power hand lens to see the mite itself. What you generally see is sort of a shiny appearance on the underside of the leaf, and you can look up examples of these symptoms if you know what you're looking for. This is one case where a Google search might actually get you where you need to be. Tomato russet mite, and it progresses upward. And if the plant is also stressed in other ways, it may just be the end of the season. But you can wash them off to some degree. You can keep the plants as healthy as possible and still get a crop out of them. And it's just one of those things that a lot of folks aren't going to recognize because they haven't had experience with it. I probably wouldn't if I hadn't had experience with it. It just wouldn't be one of the things I would think of. We tend to go towards, in our diagnoses, towards the best known disease and pest problems, Verticillium, Fusarium, nematodes. But tomatoes can get Phytophthora and rot from ground rot. They can get these mites and it can be a problem. And they tend to be more of a problem in dry, dusty climates. So don't always focus on the better known pest problems. Don't rule out the ones that actually could be minor possibilities. They can do a lot of damage. Get rid of everything this season. Sanitation is the key with this one. And by the way, ever since I did that, I've never had them since. So it was a one-time thing, and I'm glad I had it because it was a good experience. Otherwise, I never would have known about the tomato russet.
Okay, so Caitlin writes to us from Walnut Creek. Dear Don and Lois, 8 years ago, I installed a 1 foot deep raised bed or beds at the edge of my patio. I filled them with, quote, raised bed mix, unquote, from the local rock yard. And every year I amended them with homemade compost, bagged steer and chicken manure, and organic Flawn fertilizer. As most things I read suggested, I never tilled or dug the beds. I just cut the plants off when they were done, amended on top, and dug just enough to plant the new seeds or
We're
starts.
making progress.
Yes, I watered at least 30 minutes per day during the summer, more in a heat wave, with a drip system that has 20 0.5 gallon emitters for each 3 by 6 bed. So that's 1 foot tall, 6 foot long, 3 feet wide. All right. But my plants struggled wildly. They were small and unproductive, and it seemed like it got worse as time went on. And I just couldn't figure out what was going on until this past winter, when I happened to leave one bed fallow for the first time ever. When I went to plant my tomatoes, I could barely cut through all the root mass. I always thought the roots were from the previous round of vegetables, but they should have decomposed when it was fallow. So I turned it out. I turned out.
It's turned out.
It turned out my raised planters had been invaded by roots from nearby fruit trees. It took several hours of hard work to dig up the entire bed. Higher in the bed, the fine roots were an incredibly dense mat, and down at the bottom, the big roots were over an inch thick. So, this summer, my vegetables have done better than they have in years. So it seems the fruit tree roots were outcompeting the vegetables, and I need to keep those out. What would you suggest? Root barrier seems like a poor idea in beds that are only 1 foot deep. Should I just plan on completely digging up the beds every year? Any other suggestions? Thank you for your advice. I love your show.
So, for folks who don't know the geography of our area, Walnut Creek is very similar to the Davis area in terms of climate. It's East Bay, and East Bay is on our side of the Coast Range. So, it gets hot in the summer, it gets cold in the winter, and basically, it's pretty much the same climate as we are here in the Sacramento Valley. Unlike the other side of the Coast Range, where you're in Berkeley and it's cool and foggy most of the time. So, just so you understand, we're talking about a climate very similar to here. Yes, some root stocks that are used for fruit trees are really quite aggressive, actually. And in particular, the Mariana root stock, which is used for plums and apricots, is a outward spreading, vigorous root stock that has caused problems for me. I don't recommend it at all, but it's a very common root stock because it's vigorous. So that's good. If you're growing fruit trees, may want that vigor for some reason, but it can really affect everything around it. You may have at least one of your trees on the Mariana root stock. It's I would call it a riparian species, which colonizes new areas readily and takes the moisture that's there that you were hoping would go to other plants. So that's your problem right there. Yes, and particularly your peach, your nectarine might be an issue, but an apricot or plum, even more so, because that's a very common root stock for them. Barrier at the bottom of a 1 foot bed would just turn your bed into a container. And a 1 foot deep container in Walnut
And a
Creek,
1 foot deep container.
it would be, you could grow lettuce, leafy greens, summer herbs like basil, but for something that wants to get a deep root like a tomato plant, you probably couldn't water it enough if you did that. I mean, I've tested this. I've grown tomatoes and things like them, cucumbers that have, plants that have deep roots in the summer in containers to see how it works out. Some things are fine. Peppers, for example, if you put a barrier on the bottom, you could grow green peppers in there. You could grow basil in there, but your tomatoes aren't going to be very happy and you would have to water them constantly. Root barriers, however, can be put around the bed. This is a thought. The root barriers you'll find are ones that have been designed for bamboo. So if you're looking for a source locally, it will.
When you say root barrier, are you talking about a barrier going down or a barrier going to the side?
Well, I've gone
What's a root
from
barrier?
one to the other, actually. A root barrier is generally a plastic liner of one type or another. Sometimes people use landscape fabric, but I can tell you that roots can get through that. So that would just be a temporary solution. But people who are planting running bamboo, and I have a lot of familiarity with this, will use bamboo barriers, 40 to 80 mil poly, heavy duty poly. Also, for shade trees in urban areas, there have long been root barriers designed to try to deflect roots down rather than out, because in urban areas, you're planting trees in sidewalks, in road beds. And so they'll often put a barrier in to keep the roots from going out and buckling the sidewalk and doing damage to the roadway. These are heavy duty materials. The 40 to 80 mil plastic used for bamboo is tough stuff to work with, but it is solid. It definitely keeps bamboo in place, installed properly, and would definitely keep roots out of your bed for a while. Roots can go under it, but they're not inclined to. I know this sounds like I'm anthropomorphizing, but generally speaking, roots go in the direction of least resistance. Like your raised bed was just perfect for them. They thought that was paradise. Once they get in there, you've created a wonderful mulch of stuff for that nearby fruit tree. A physical barrier applied on the fruit tree side, going down 18 inches, which is a very common size for root barriers, or 24 inches. You're going to need to dig a trench. You're going to need to install it securely, and it could possibly block the roots as they come towards the planter from the fruit tree. Obviously, you put it on the fruit tree side of the planter and around to some degree. This can hold it back for quite a while. Roots don't go over a barrier typically. Bamboo sometimes does, but they almost never go under a barrier. They're just deflected and they grow along the barrier. So when you're doing running bamboo, you'll find the bamboo rhizomes hit the barrier, turn, and just follow the barrier and go back into the bed if they need to. It does work. You can hold back running bamboo. And we're talking about a really aggressive outward spreading root system. You can hold back running bamboo with these for many years. You need to monitor them, as you would need to monitor your bed. Dig down on that side every season at the start of the season, see if any roots kind of came up through there somehow and cut them out. But that would be easier in some ways than having to annually redig that entire bed, which is what you'll probably have to do if you don't do anything. You'll just basically have to dig everything out each year, re-amend it. That's fine. Please understand, we always tell you not to till. It's better for the soil not to till, not to turn the soil. There are times when we do. Okay, sometimes we break our own rules. And this would be a case where you would have to. You're just not going to succeed in here trying to plant into a mass of roots of a plum tree. So you will have to dig them out if you don't do anything else. So your first alternative is just every year, starting on the fruit tree side, dig down, see what you've got, cut them off at the very least and let them break down. Even better, dig them out entirely. But at least for starters, I would probably put a trench on that side, dig down there, dig a trench on that side, dig down there, find the ones that have invaded and cut them off, knowing they're going to reinvade. You're just trying to get ahead of them for that season. A barrier would give you at least a couple years head start and probably several years if you go ahead and splurge for the higher quality 40 to 80 mil bamboo barrier. Bamboo nurseries in your area, and they exist. They're mostly in North Bay, up in the it's a lovely drive up in the Occidental, not Petaluma, Sebastopol area. There are nurseries up there that can help you. Nurseries around the Bay Area. Just look for bamboo nurseries and root barrier, rhizome barrier, and that might help you out in this situation. You only need a few feet of it is the issue. So you're probably just gonna have to go there and buy a little piece they'll cut for you. Hard to say where you'll find that, but that is one option. The other alternative, unfortunately, is every year you're gonna have to go in there and dig out the roots as they reinvade. Yeah, roots of trees. I'm more accustomed to getting these questions about like the neighbor's redwood tree. It's right on the fence line, and you put your vegetable garden on your side of the fence line. Aside from creating a straight avenue for squirrels there, you've typically created an avenue for the roots to go in. Roots will grow happily in amended soil that's got constant moisture through the summer. Privets are another one because they're well known for this. Bay trees. I mean, you should probably, before you, this actually would be a good general topic. You should probably, before you build your vegetable raised planter, think hard about the issues of where you place it. So a raised vegetable planter in the middle of your yard with nothing around it, although it's hotter and drier and needs more frequent irrigation, all that kind of thing, you're less likely to have squirrel problems because you're going to make them run across the yard to get into your bed. It'll be
And it's
easier.
not going to have a sparrow problem because
Right?
they want to be next to a bush.
Right. So we often locate it for, aesthetic considerations or design-wise, we put it over there, sort of out of sight, and then we end up creating problems for ourselves. In here, in this particular case, it's the neighbor's tree or your tree that are causing the problems. So be aware of those. And some trees have very aggressive roots, no question about it. I've mentioned bamboo, which of course is famous for, but many other trees have roots that are quite problematic. Bamboo is just a giant grass with tough rhizomes, and there are products that have been developed for use. In fact, you know what? You could put bamboo barrier around this and put bamboo in the raised planter. That would be
Next is a question that says, what is this yellow flower blooming in June? It's at Montgomery School in South Davis. I see it here in full sun. Does it also grow in light shade? And there are pictures.
Yeah, this is a grassy
Some
looking
pictures I
plant.
took.
It has an iris-like leaf, and then it has these lovely, fuzzy, strange blossoms that stand above them, usually on stems that stand 1 to 2 feet above the leaves. And this is Anagazanthus.
Gesundheit.
Yeah, that's what you're supposed to say whenever we say Anagazanthus. Common name is kangaroo paw. We had a really funny go-around with a customer the other day because she came in looking for monkey paws. And this is the issue with
Monkey paw. Oh, I
monkey
must have
paws. Yeah,
pawed it.
she asked for monkey paws. And we're going monkey paws. At this point, we start Googling common names when people do this kind of thing. Of course, there is a plant called monkey paws. It wasn't this. And she looked at the picture and we wouldn't be here anyway. And she goes, no. It's got these fuzzy flowers. Well, that's all I needed to hear, the fuzzy flowers. Kangaroo paws, not monkey paws. Never seen a kangaroo paw up close, but I'll take it for granted that they're fuzzy. Kangaroo paw, Anagazanthos. Sometimes spelled with a U instead of an O at the end, but the correct spelling is, according to my Western Garden book, with an O, Anagazanthos, kangaroo
Spell the
paw.
whole thing, Don. The whole thing.
Anigozanthos, Anagazanthos.
Thank you. Yeah.
One of the funny things about being in the nursery business for 4+ decades is watching plants come in and then go out of our industry. And 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago, there was a company that was importing plants from Australia and trying to popularize them for the California market. And good reason. Many plants from Australia do very, very well in California because many parts of Australia are very similar to many parts of California. They fit beautifully in landscapes where we're using California natives, Mediterranean natives, South African natives, Australian natives. These all tend to work very well with the same kind of irrigation. And they all tend to be plants that need reasonably good drainage and some care with the frequency of irrigation and minimal fertilizing. Many of them actually are better off not fertilized. So they were introducing grevilleas and some other plants. And what they came out with Anagazanthus, the kangaroo paw, with this iris-like leaf and these fascinating, brightly colored, fuzzy flowers. And they were selling them as what you might call florist items. That's a term we use in our trade for ones that are being sold in bloom, small plants. You're just going to enjoy them that way and then probably throw them out after you've enjoyed them for a while. They tended to rot. They did not succeed well in most people's gardens at first. And so a lot of us just kind of stopped carrying them. We considered Anagazanthus kind of a failure. I mean, when it was initially introduced to the market in the 1980s and 1990s, it was just one of those plants that production issues and people had bad results with it. But you know what? There's a lot of species in that genus. Some of them are much bigger plants. Some of them have 2 to 3 foot leaves and blooms that stand a couple feet above that. And
Yeah.
so after a decade, and everybody'd forgotten about what a disaster they were the first time around, in came this plant again to the nursery trade, but very different, much bigger plants. There's always a market for accent plants, as we call them. Designers use that term. It's plants with dramatic foliage or a grassy leaf or an iris-like leaf to be a contrast to the more typical landscape plants. Fortnite lily was widely used. Agapanthus has been used for that purpose. Many grasses, the whole period of ornamental grasses, the craze for those in the 1990s, which has now settled down to just maybe a half a dozen species widely used in the trade. Right now, Dionellas, Lomandras, and Anagazanthus. Got that? Dionellas, Lomandras, and Anagazanthus are very, very
Gesundheit.
popular. Gesundheit. And the new Anagazanthus are great garden plants. They're not showing a propensity to rot particularly any more than a lot of other plants, and they're giving this bloom that begins in April, May, and continues right through the summer, all the way into the fall. In Southern California and coastal areas, landscapers started mass planting them. Going down to visit my parents in their later years and driving around La Jolla, Pacific Beach, landscapers would put in 20 or 30 of them in a bed. And that's quite a show, quite spectacular. And my mother was very enchanted by them and bought one, which is the way she did things, and put it as a focal point in her cactus and succulent garden. Single plant near aloes, agaves, cactus, and it never stopped blooming in that climate. And she bought one of the bigger ones. Hummingbirds love them. They're all over them. And they're very drought tolerant, at least in the coastal zones, and reasonably so here in the Sacramento Valley. And the bloom is nonstop. The only issue typically is keeping the soil too wet, where you've got dense soil causing them to rot at the crown. Other than that, they're generally pretty tough and adaptable. They are a little cold sensitive. The first ones were cold tender here and would get damaged in the winter. These new species and varieties are tougher, but I think they're really only going to grow in USDA zones 9 and 10, sunset zones 8, 9, 14 to 24. So you're not going to do well with them as you go uphill too far. Any of you living at a couple thousand foot elevation happen to have experience with Anaxanthus? Send us a note, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I would be curious if these newer varieties and newer species are hardier, cold hardier than the original ones that came on the market. Great plant, and I'm happy to see these going into commercial landscapes because they really give a big spot of color and they can go pretty low water. So they check a lot of boxes in terms of uses in the landscape. Good in containers, by the way. You've got a great big fancy container that someone gave you, one of those $300 pots that you're looking at it more than anything that goes into it. You want some dramatic plant to go in there. Anaxanthus, a single one of those in a very lovely container, can last for 10 or 15 years. They don't need to be transplanted. They don't need special attention, grooming, trimming, dividing, any of that. So it's a very low input plant for the amount of bloom it gives.
All right. And then from the mailbag, we have a message from Gina who says, "Hi there. I was wondering why blueberries were only grown in Oregon 30 years ago. At least that was my impression. Now they can be grown in California and seemingly in a variety of climate zones. It is so nice to have them available so much longer now. I would love to hear more about their story." So, Don, blueberries?
Yes, there have always been high bush and low bush blueberries. And people from upper Midwest or places like that were most familiar with the low bush blueberries.
Oh,
And
yeah.
then they were the classic. They tend to be smaller fruited, more intensely flavored, I'm told.
And the kids in the neighborhood each had their own little patch. I had my patch. I was in Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and there was a spot that I knew exactly where those blueberry was. It was a little opening in the woods, and they got enough sun, and they
They're
got enough.
wild. They were native, yeah,
Wild, of course they're wild.
they
Why
might
would you
be.
have non-wild blueberries,
So they
man?
might be one or
Wild
two
blueberries.
feet tall, and be kind of a hassle to pick them. So northern high bush blueberries have been around for a long time. It's interesting to know the blueberry hybridization and development for agriculture is actually pretty new in the United States. They didn't really introduce a lot of varieties until the early 20th century. In the last 10 to 20 years, I have seen more varieties of blueberries than almost any other fruit category I can think of. Partly because of the antioxidant craze of about 20 years ago, when the research showed that fruit with blue was better for you. There you go, there's your advertising slogan. Fruit with red is pretty good too. So, fruit with high content of pigments like that contained antioxidants that were supposed to help prevent cancer and had a lot of other benefits. So, suddenly, anything like a blueberry or a red fruit, like a cranberry or pomegranates or goji berries or any of these things suddenly caught on. In the case of the ones I just mentioned, blueberries also happen to taste really delicious. Goji berry tastes awful. I haven't yet tasted one that I thought was any good. Cranberries, well, you got to do things to cranberries to make them palatable, obviously, a lot of sugar and pomegranates. But these other ones that we're talking about are all somewhat challenging. Marketing cranberries, you're not going to go pick them and take them as a snack in your lunch. But boy, you put out blueberries, everybody's going to like those. There were then southern high bush blueberries developed. There's probably 15 or 20 species in the genus Vaccinium that have been used for hybridization. And when we first opened in 1981, there were southern high bush blueberries and rabbit eye blueberries, which were sold in the southeastern United States. Not out here in the West, the arid West. It just wasn't thought that we would do well with blueberries out here. We didn't have what they needed for a bunch of reasons. But these were taller plants. with bigger fruit that was easier to pick. And I remember debates at the time about whether we could grow them out here and also whether those were as good as the northern lowbush blueberries. And I'm sure people who lived in the north thought that those were better, and people in the south probably thought that theirs were better. An interesting genus of plants, Vaccinium, are almost entirely from places where it rains and there's a lot of deciduous leaves falling on the ground every fall. So a
Right.
good mulch of leaves. We always thought we couldn't sell them in our area because the pH of our water was 8, rather alkaline water, and it had a lot of salts in it. And so people who would buy blueberries would stick them in the ground and just thinking you could plant them like a normal shrub, and they would get anemic, they wouldn't grow well, and they would basically die. It looked like they were burning from the heat, but it was a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of factors. Newer varieties did come on the market that were easier to grow, particularly new forms of the southern highbush blueberry. Within the last 20 years, they've sequenced the genome of blueberries and they've looked at the 10 or 11 species involved inadvertently in hybridization originally, and now they're intentionally breeding for larger fruit, firmer texture. Firmer texture is really important from a commercial standpoint, and actually for home gardeners as well to some degree. You want a fruit that's going to hold up when you pick it, take it, ship it, whatever you're going to do with it, and more tolerance of a wide range of conditions. And about 20 years ago in Davis, we shifted our water supply to 15 years ago. And so now we have a better quality water as well. So people started buying these new types of blueberries and finding, you know what? They grow here. Even though the pH of the water is still high, they grow just fine as long as you give them the basics of what they need. And while their southern high bush were the basis of all this, meaning shrubs about the size of a rose bush, so 4 to 6 feet after a couple of years, there were dwarfer versions of southern high bush coming on the market aimed at the home garden trade. So there's a bunch of varieties now that only get 2 to 3 feet tall. Then you could even, at least in theory, keep them in a container. Pretty challenging in our climate, but you can at least if you wanted to do that. But they're more compact, so you didn't have to devote as much space to blueberries in your garden as you used to have to. So there's new varieties with bigger fruit, firmer fruit, very good flavor, and more heat tolerant and more compact growth habit. That's been the breeding trend of a lot of the horticultural industries that are aiming at the home garden market, and then a slightly different direction of what they've been breeding for use in agriculture. Now, blueberries are a big crop in California, relatively speaking. There's a big blueberry farm near Stockton. Stockton, for those of you who don't know, is right here in the Delta and gets just as hot as we do in the summer in Davis and get just as cold in the winter. Just as is a little closer to the ocean, but more interior than ocean in terms of the climate. And they're a big producer. I had a kid who worked for me, went to Austria. He's in a grocery store in Vienna, Austria, looking at the big box of blueberries there. This is 10 years ago or so. And they were from Stockton, California. So they're actually exporting them to Austria from Northern California. I never thought I would see that day. So yes, new varieties have made a big difference.
So when I was growing up, and the listeners need to know that I grew up in Backwoods, Michigan, which is way up north by Canada,
It's
and
Canada, really. It's not America, North America. I'm not the United States.
it's its own state, the Upper Peninsula of
Yes.
Michigan. It's a yeah, the 51st state. Well, no, we didn't make it, not quite. Anyway, so when I was there, and of course the blueberries are all wild blueberries. If anybody wanted to grow a blueberry in their yard or something, we were always told you had to dig up the soil that it was growing in because of the mycorrhiza that were with it. And that's where I actually learned that word, mycorrhiza. And is that still true? Was it ever true? Is it still true?
We know that soil mycorrhizae are important for many plants, and we know that many species of plants have particular populations of several species of soil mycorrhizae that live on and in the roots, endo and ectoparasites, and that does make a big difference, but there's no practical way to import those from upper Michigan to Northern California, and we don't really want people sending soil around anyway. So,
Right.
what you're buying in a nursery is a nursery grown blueberry plant. And people are, to answer your question anecdotally, people are planting them without adding any special mycorrhiza and getting very good results. What blueberries need, in my opinion, is a steady breakdown of organic material for their roots, even moisture, and great care not to burn them with conventional fertilizers. Those are the three things that have made people successful with blueberries here in the Sacramento Valley, where it's way hotter than it ever would be in Upper Michigan and way drier than it ever would be in Upper Michigan. So I've grown them in big planters because that was convenient for me. Livestock troughs just worked very well. And I did a mix of our citrus soil mix combined with our really high quality organic soil mix that's used for vegetables and cannabis and things like that. About a 2 to 3 to 1, 2 or 3 to 1 ratio of the citrus mix with the high organic mix. What I'm doing there is giving them kind of what they would have where they come from, a mineral soil with a lot of sand and pumice and stuff in it, and organic material steadily breaking down for the roots every season. And what I would do when I did them in planters is I would just top dress the planter with the organic soil at the beginning of April or sometime around then, when it first starts to feel warm and I'm beginning to irrigate. I used micro sprayers rather than drippers because I wanted the even distribution that they provide. I ran them at least 2 to 3 times a week. You cannot let blueberries dry out. They will get severely damaged if the roots dry out. What it comes down to is they have fragile, finely divided, but very vigorous root systems. And this is true of a lot of plants that are characteristically from deciduous forests, from places where it rains in summer. That's one nice part, one key element, but also where they get this constant supply of breaking down organic material. That seems to be way more important than soil pH. And this is really probably the classic example of where all of our advice for a good 40 plus years was misdirected because we were focused on the pH. Your water is too alkaline to grow blueberries. Your soil is too alkaline to grow blueberries. You need to correct the and make it more acidic. Well, I've done that. I've taken a couple of cups of sulfur, soil sulfur, turned it in whenever I plant a blueberry. Just why not? I mean, there it is, and it helps to some degree for a season or two. But it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to make a long-term corrective to your soil pH. You can correct it, bring it down 1 to 2 points for a season, and then you got to do that again the next year. If and which means you have to turn it in around the roots, and you don't want to be doing that around a blueberry because you'll be cutting through the roots when you do it. You can throw it on the surface, and that helps a little bit. But we now know that it isn't the pH itself; it's the characteristic of the soils that have a low pH, which is a lot of organic material, steady moisture. Probably that's creating humic acid or something like that. That's a big arguing point amongst researchers and permaculture folks and all that. I won't get into the middle of that. The pH itself is very difficult to correct, and it isn't that crucial that you make that change. The reason I can say this is that we started selling blueberries in Davis when we went to a surface water source for the city of Davis. Now most of our water comes from the Sacramento River. It's not the high salt groundwater that it used to be. It's only that about 10 or 20% of the time. Most of it is surface water. The pH is still high. The city is correcting the pH to make it more alkaline because they didn't want to bring this new water through old iron pipes and have iron oxides and things start showing up in the drinking water. So they actually still have, we still have slightly alkaline, somewhat alkaline water in Davis. More to the point, my personal domestic well, the pH of my water is 8.1. Okay. 7.0 is neutral. Below 7 is acidic. My water is 8.1. And in the several years in which I decided to grow blueberries and see if I could get to the point of having too many blueberries, I didn't correct for the pH except at the time of planting. I'm watering with high salt laden, high pH water, and they flourished. They did fine. They did not even show micronutrient deficiencies as long as I kept them mulched and kept them evenly moist. So that was really clearly the key. The pH of the water, the pH of the soil was not that big a factor. And we need to kind of get away from walking into the nursery and going, can I bring the pH down to 6? I want to grow this or that. Don't worry about it. pH is not that big a factor. It was, in my opinion, very misdirected research and practical recommendations in the post-World War II era. We've gotten away from that. We know more about soil science now, but what really matters is what Lois was talking about, those mycorrhiza, the soil environment, the things around the roots that are helping to bring nutrients into the roots and provide and increase its reach for water. I mean, that's one of the things that mycorrhizae do. They increase the root's ability to take in moisture and to take in nutrients like iron and manganese and zinc in the root zone. So mulch, organic material, even moisture. And when you apply conventional fertilizers, most plants that we grow in our gardens that are from areas like this, where it's a high organic material, summer rainfall area, are pretty sensitive to salts. And so if you take a conventional fertilizer something like sulfate of ammonia based or urea based fertilizer, the regular package fertilizer, not an organic fertilizer, and feed your blueberries with that. If you just increase the dose a little beyond the label recommendation, sometimes even using the label recommendation, those fine, fragile roots will be burned. Yes, they will recover, but what you will see is burnt edges and tips on the leaves and look pretty unsightly. And obviously that's not good for the plant either. They'll probably outgrow it, but it's not a great way to go. So I strongly recommend, if you feed them at all, use an organic fertilizer. And you don't actually typically need to feed them if your choice, there's another way to feed them. Your choice of an organic mulch, if it contains something that's a fertilizer, seabird guano, bat guano, composted chicken manure, things like that, that'll take care of the nitrogen needs of the plant. And yes, by the way, we did get to the point by the third year of the project where we had too many blueberries. That was
There
my
is no
goal,
such
to
thing,
see
Don.
if we could get to the point of so many blueberries, we didn't know what to do with them all. We reached that point in about the third year with one, two, three, five plants. Two of them were in barrels. One of them was in a livestock. Three of them were in a livestock trough. Two were in barrels. Micro spray system, full sun, just so you know, full sun in the Sacramento Valley, because I wanted to test that because I knew there were, blueberry farms in full sun. That was fine as long as they got the moisture that they needed. I did do one plant further down the same area in a barrel where it was more shade. It was about half sun. Plant grew fine, looked lovely, by the way. It looked kind of more open growth habit, produced about half as many fruit. You would be happy with it. If you were just growing them at home, you would have been satisfied with that one. But it is an interesting phenomenon to have been able to grow too many blueberries in the Sacramento Valley, to the point that we're giving them away. This was several years ago. Now, I have to say this about blueberries. This is not sustainable. You're not going to just stick them in the ground like a landscape shrub and have them take. This isn't like a rose bush or something where it'll be a permanent part of your landscape, because having a steady supply of organic material breaking down is not a normal phenomenon here. And that kind of moisture is a lot of water. I mean, they were the same water input basically as my vegetable garden. They can be done in containers, but the bigger the container, the better. You need something the size of a barrel, oak barrel, or close to that. And it is mentioned in many references that you should have two for cross-pollination. That's a very interesting subject. First of all, blueberries are pollinated by bumblebees, not honeybees. Honeybees are inefficient at it. So bumblebees or carpenter bees are probably doing the job here in our area. They found that if you just had one plant or one type of plant, you would get very good yield, but the fruit would be one particular size. And if they were pollinated, the fruit would be half again bigger. So it doesn't increase the number of fruit, it increases fruit size. If you're a farmer, that means you're getting more pounds. So your yield is improved by bringing in honeybee hives, or even better, bumblebee hives, but they use honeybees because they have to. You'll get more, it's worth the cost of bringing in the bees and having the two different varieties. One plant will produce fruit for you at home. You'll be happy with it. The fruit will be smaller. If you want bigger fruit, more pounds, plant two. And you can plant two, I've done this, together in one big barrel. Or you can plant three together in a livestock trough. And eventually you'll get to the point of having too many blueberries.
And notice that Lois will always accept blueberries.
That's
No problem. If you've got
right.
too many, just let me know.
And that's where that firmer textured fruit that they've been breeding for is actually a desirable characteristic, because it travels better. So if you've ever grown blueberries, you know that you've got all different stages of ripening on the plant. One of the hassles with making it a commercial crop has been harvest sequence, harvest input costs, because having a whole harvest crew go through a field repeatedly to pick is obviously more expensive than going through all at once. And anytime you're picking from a blueberry, you have unripe fruit, overripe fruit, very ripe fruit, all together in the same area. And you can't really shake them off that easily. So it doesn't lend itself, as far as I know, to mechanical harvest. I'm sure they're working on that, but that's been a challenge. So one thing you will find is you'll be picking fruit at all different stages of development. The other thing you'll look into is whether you've got early, mid-season, and late. And so I carefully planted early, mid-season, and late varieties. The range of ripening is only about 4 to 6 weeks for the most part. I mean, yes, there's some that start in April and some that are ripening in late May, and that's most of what you get. But a few varieties, Sunshine Blue is a good example, the fruit will keep forming and you'll have some fruit on there even into the middle of the summer. So that's a nice bonus. So look for ones that continue to produce during the summer if you want that. And I mentioned that one in particular because almost anywhere you're listening in California, Sunshine Blue will do well. It only needs 100 chilling hours. You can get that even just almost on the coast of San Diego. In fact, they're growing that one in San Diego. So Sunshine Blue in particular has really caught on. Large fruit, good flavor, low chilling hours, very adaptable. Almost anywhere you're listening to this program, at least in a lowland area, Sunshine Blue would be fine. If you're in a highland area, you got a whole lot of other choices. So just check at your local garden center.
So, listeners have heard me talk about growing up in backwoods Michigan frequently. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about what it's like there, differed from what it's like here. Now, here in the Sacramento Valley, it's hot, it's dry, then it's cool and rainy, and it's agricultural land. There's very little woodlands here. Where I grew up in Upper Peninsula of Michigan, actually, Michigan, Canada, Upper Wisconsin, Minnesota, and all the way over to the ocean in Oregon, you know, all of that area is northern forest and it's woodlands. Now, it's not giant trees like the redwoods or anything. It's shorter trees, but there's lots of trees there. And it's a climate where they grow well. So when I would leave my house as a kid and walk across the street and go into the woods, because that's what was across the street, the soil was, well, it wasn't rocks.
No.
It wasn't hard. If you tried to dig down, what you would find is what we call duff.
Yep.
It is so many years worth of leaves decomposing, because you know a lot of this is deciduous trees there, and they'd shed their leaves and they'd be down, and then the snow would come and leave, and then when the snow melted, it would all get, you know, rained in and watered in, and the leaves would just sit there and disintegrate. So you ended up with a soil that is so much different than what we have here. It's just astonishing.
Well, it's
So
basically
wherever you are, look at your, go out, find yourself a woods and go look at it.
find yourself a woods. It's gonna be a long walk here.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's
Yes.
different here.
Well, one thing I learned in forestry class many years ago is the 10, 20, 30, 40 rule. For a to sustain a coniferous forest, 40 inches of rain minimum. There are species that can take less, but in general, 40 inches plus will be conifers. 30 to 40 inches, deciduous trees, and a mix of conifers and deciduous hardwood species. 20 to 30 inches of rain, perennial grassland with some species of deciduous, some possible species of conifers, but shrinking numbers of those. 10 to 20 inches of rain, like here, annual grasslands with some perennial grasses here and there, some deciduous species, a handful of evergreen. I mean, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of an evergreen species. So if you're growing things that are from an area that has deciduous hardwoods or conifers, it is a place that gets steady rainfall, 30 to 40 inches a year, often much more than that, can be 80 inches or more, and a steady supply of leaves and needles coming down. And we get the question every now and then, oh, my neighbor has redwoods and the needles have been dropping. Does that affect the soil? Should I be concerned about it? Is it going to bring the pH down too low? Imagine if that were the case, if that could possibly be true. The best answer to that I got was many years ago from Dr. Chalker Scott up at Washington State, where her answer was basically yes over many millennia, but not over the course of your lifetime or the course of even a generational, several generations.
So the answer is no.
The answer is no, you don't need to worry about it. Nor does it help to go out and get needles like that if you're trying to reduce the pH, but they can improve the organic content of the soil. We don't push the notion of turning in organic material here. That's generally breaking up the soil, adding stuff in there. You've done harm to the soil web when you do this, but you've added organic material into the soil, which sort of mitigates that. But if you do that year after year after year, your soil doesn't get a chance to develop the extensive and very effective soil web that we get when we leave it alone. But if you let them pile up on the surface, you find that wonderful layer right where it's breaking down, right where there's native soil below 2, 3, 4, 8, 10 inches of whatever you brought in, arborist wood chips, needles, leaves, whatever. It's really active there. The temperatures are relatively high. The moisture is pretty consistent no matter what. And you'll get worms moving up and back down. You'll get mycorrhizae invading, and you'll get all the wonderful fungal organisms that are breaking down all that organic material. It really creates something that's great for plant growth. And it makes a whole different rhizosphere for the plants that are there. And some plants really need that. So what we found is that for some of the things that we've always grown here, that we were always referred to as acid-loving plants, camellias, azaleas, things like that, really what they need and benefit from is that kind of a mulch, an organic mulch consistently breaking down that would happen in the places camellias and azaleas actually grow, where there's maple leaves, 2 feet of them mulching themselves around those plants every winter and breaking down and steadily decomposing. We know that there are certain insect pests, insect beneficial insects that live in that zone. The leatherwing beetle, soldier beetles, that's where their larvae spend a year plus developing in that fine layer between organic material and the soil. When they emerge as adults, they feed on aphids and they're voracious aphid feeders. So leaving that kind of mulch is beneficial, even if you don't happen to be growing the plants that prefer that. If you're going to grow things from those regions or those types of climates, it's beneficial to bring in that organic material, either buying compost or just taking your leaves in the fall. This is a very timely conversation here in September. If we go into leaf raking season, late October and November, take those leaves, spread them out around those kinds of plants, and they'll be very beneficial. We let leaves and stuff build up around our camellias here for 20 years. And I have camellias, again, pH of my water is 8.1. I have camellias that are growing just fine because I have a constant supply of organic material mulching the roots of those camellias. There's some plants, people need to understand root systems of plants differ. Some plants would come in bare root, for example, that I would buy in, birches, metasequoia. I would try buying them in from growers and they'd come in and they're just this network of tiny, fine roots. There's not a branched root system like your peach tree has. There's not a taproot like your walnut has. I would look at these and go, these need to get into something right away. These are going to dry out if we try to store them in shavings. We would pot those right away. Not all plants' roots are identical, comparable, or similar at all. And some of them are more fragile than others. We know that. And in the case of these plants that grow in areas with a constant filtering down of organic material, they tend to have a very fine network of roots that goes out and needs pretty consistent moisture. But the organic material provides the nutrients the plants need.
Okay, so the next question we have is this one's been hanging around for a little while because Don was going to do a little research. This is from Ben, who's in San Fernando Valley in Southern California. And dear Don and Lois, I love beans. I was wondering what you all think about powder inoculation of beans to plant in the garden. I thought mycorrhiza and other microbes that the plants need were already in the soil. Is there any benefit from adding powdered inoculation? Or conversely, is it possible to negatively disrupt native soil microbial ecosystems by introducing factory-produced competitors? Perhaps these guys are pretty universal, or the natives just always have the home niche advantage. Thank you for entertaining such diverse questions. And thank you, Ben, for sending us such diverse
And
questions.
for your patience on this one, seems like a very good time now because a lot to answer this because a lot of people are coming in looking for fava beans for a cover crop for their vegetable gardens to plant in the wintertime, plant now for the wintertime. And that's one of the best nitrogen fixing legumes there is. You can plant it anytime. Late September through February, and it grows through the winter, and it's pulling nitrogen out of the air by the nodules on the roots and leaving that in the soil if you harvest the plant at the right time. It will probably produce more nitrogen if you shake the beans in a mycorrhizal powder, but all of your questions are the same things that come up in every discussion about this online and amongst experts. Do you really need it? Probably not. Your soil already has plenty of mycorrhiza in it. Does it have the right kind of mycorrhiza? Probably some of the species. There's a dozen plus species of mycorrhiza that are common, and many, many more than that probably could be identified. Getting exactly the right mycorrhiza for a particular plant is highly challenging. Mycorrhizal research was very big in the 1990s. Every trade show we went to, there were new products on the market based on this research. Look, here's the mycorrhiza we need for these kinds of shrubs. Here's the mycorrhiza we need for legumes and so forth. And there have always been companies that were willing to sell bean and pea seeds already coated with the inoculant in a seed coating format, just as they used to sell them covered with fungicides. I mean, they're willing to do this stuff for people if farmers and gardeners think it'll give them a greater yield and that there's a market for it. We found those powdered mycorrhizal products were really a pain. Putting them in a bag and selling them, they leaked like crazy. We couldn't see any clear result from them. It wasn't the kind of thing like nitrogen where you say, oh, wow, look, the plant's growing more and yielding more. It wasn't giving us what we would call measurable results, and the demand wasn't there. So we just stopped carrying them a long time ago. Some of the companies started putting them in fertilizers. So if you really want to add mycorrhiza, EB Stone and Son is a company we work with. All of their organic fertilizer products, they add mycorrhiza to. And it's a fairly similar mix between the different packaged products of the different species that are added. I do not know how effective it is to add mycorrhiza to a bagged dry commercial fertilizer product. I have not seen efficacy data on that one way or another. I know it's not harmful, so it meets our criteria, what I call the Linda Chalker Scott dictum. Is it necessary? Is it harmful? If it's neither, go for it. So I don't think it's necessary because in garden soils, you already have mycorrhizae. Is it harmful? Probably not. Although there was some research that suggested that introduced mycorrhizae would compete with the native mycorrhizae in an undesirable manner. Perhaps for some plants, who knows, for your garden crops. It's one of those things I've never bothered with. And I don't think it makes a significant difference in yield for most people. The consensus of one long discussion of this online with a bunch of people who are experts was if your soil had been stripped off, and your neighborhood had been subdivided, and then they built the house, and now you're dealing with whatever remained, subsoil, bedrock, then you've got a different challenge, but subsoil, they've perhaps taken away all the active organic part of the soil. They've taken away the populations of mycorrhiza, and you might want to rebuild them somehow. You want to rebuild your soil, is what it comes down to. And they didn't take away every speck of the mycorrhiza. You can't do that. These are tiny, tiny organisms. So they're there. They're ready to rebuild. They're ready to repopulate if you give them what they need, which typically is new soil and organic material on that soil to make a more favorable environment and a steady, consistent supply of irrigation. My guess is building the soil will make more difference than adding mycorrhiza. That's my summary as a non-expert from conversations between experts. You will find all kinds of conflicting advice on this. Some people swear by mycorrhiza. Others tell you I didn't do any good whatsoever. Putting them in fertilizer, I don't know if it works or not. I'm not going to say one way or another, but it certainly doesn't hurt, and it didn't significantly increase the cost of the fertilizer. So a simple answer might be at your favorite local garden center, look at the fertilizer products on the shelf, look on the side and see if they list having added mycorrhiza. They've probably added the 8 or 10 best known species, and that may be the simplest way to deal with this. Buying mycorrhizal products, shaking the seeds in it, kind of unpleasant, uncomfortable. And I can't tell you that it's good or bad to get it on your fingers and on your nose and in your eyes. It's probably not great. So my suggestion would be if you're going to apply them at all, do it through a conventional fertilizer product.
Well, here's our quote for the day. More, more, more is my garden motto. If growing a single kind of daylily is one of life's good things, then growing 30, 40, or even 100 of them is one of life's even better things. And this is a quote by Alan Lacy.
100 daylilies.
I think that without the daylily thing, more, more, more is definitely a gardener's
We do
goal.
tend to be collectors in certain categories. It's been interesting to watch young people come work for me. I have a steady series of interns who have become employees in many cases, and watch how they get interested in gardening. They often come in, nursery's a cool place to work, what a fun place to work. Wow. These are, what do you call them? Carnivorous plants? Wait, how do they work? They eat insects? Oh my God, this is, can I grow it in the house? Next thing you know, they're into carnivorous plants. One of my employees is very into bonsai. He makes one every week when he comes in. He's learned how to make really good bonsai. That's what he happened to get into. So usually it's one group of plants that pulls you in and you start collecting that, then you broaden out into the other things. Pretty soon.
African violets, yeah.
Yeah. We all went through one phase or another.
Yeah.
So, you've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.